This is the fourth day of this January 2008 Rohatsu session. And we'll resume reading from our text, The Practice of Zen by C.C. Chang. We left off yesterday reading from Discourse of Master Hanshan. The last little paragraph we read was, what you should do is take up this awareness as if holding a sharp sword in your hand. No matter whether Buddha or devils come, just cut them off like a snarl of entangled silk threads. Use all your attention and strength patiently to push your mind to the very dead end of consciousness. Just push it on and on. One of the more common questions I get in Dokusan is basically how much to push in one's effort. And, you know, when he says push here, he really means to just persist, to press the mind, to probe with the mind. To bore into, it's ultimately there's no one pushing anything, and so long as there is this sense of dualism, a dichotomy of I'm pushing the practice, then one still has further to go. It really means just intently persist in one's absorption. He goes on, those who determine to practice the Dharma should believe firmly the teaching of mind only. The Buddha said, all the three realms are mind, all 10,000 dharmas are consciousness. And then Hanshan says, all Buddhism is nothing but an exposition of this sentence. So let's reread that sentence. All the three realms are mind, all 10,000 dharmas are consciousness. Dharmas, when it's plural, means things, phenomena. So 10,000 dharmas, all the 10,000 dharmas is every conceivable phenomenon, physical or mental, material or immaterial. The three realms are it's often called the three worlds, are the worlds of form, desire, and no form. I'll read here from the footnote because it's very succinct. Say the highest realm is called the realm of non-form. Sentient beings of this realm have no bodily form, existing only in the expression of different states of consciousness. The second realm is called the realm of form. Sentient beings of this domain have bodily form, but no desires. The third realm is called the realm of desires. Sentient beings of this realm have many different kinds of desires and fears. Animals, human beings, beings in hell, and those in certain regions of heavenly realms all belong to this domain of desire. Now these, when it says human beings and animals, these are themselves called the two of the six realms of unenlightened existence. And these six realms can be understood in a figurative as well as a literal way. So although we are all human beings here, when you could say that when we are free of desire, in the deepest zazen, then we are no longer limited as human beings. And then he finally says, sentient beings of the two upper realms, that is, non-form and form, are those who have gained various stages of samadhi. Anyway, again, that sentence, the Buddha said, all the three realms are mind. All the 10,000 dharmas are consciousness. All Buddhism is nothing but an exposition of this sentence. Ignorance or enlightenment, virtue or wickedness, cause or effect, are nothing but one's own mind. Not one iota of anything exists outside of mind. The Zen practitioner should completely cast aside his former knowledge and understandings. Here, scholarship or cleverness is useless. Rather, he should look on the whole world as hallucinatory. What he sees are mirages, mirror images, like the moon reflected in the water. The sounds he hears are hymns of the wind blowing through the trees. He should see all manifestations as clouds floating in the sky, changing and unreal. Not only the outer world, but all habitual thoughts, passions, distractions, and desires within one's own mind are likewise insubstantial, non-concrete, rootless, and floating. Whenever any thought arises, you should try to find its source. Never let it go easily or be cheated by it. If you can practice like this, you will be doing some solid work. Well, this is again a reference to that practice we read from, it was mentioned yesterday in our reading. But just to look at this again, describing thoughts, not just thoughts, but passions, distractions, and desires are insubstantial. No substance to them. So non-concrete. Rootless. They're floating. They're unmoored. And yet, habitually, we react to these thoughts as though they have substance to them and that they're real in that way, when they're just like dust of the mind, but not even dust. Dust at least has some substance. Thoughts are without substance. They're just basically firings, neuronal firings in the brain. But when we attach to them, when we cling to them, they can wreak havoc in the mind. He continues, there are many koans which help you to work in the tumult of worldly activities, like the one, who is it who recites the name of Buddha? Although this koan is most helpful, you must realize that it is merely a stone for knocking upon the door. When the door is opened, the stone is thrown away. To work on the koan, you must have firmness, unshakable determination, and solid perseverance. You should not have the least hesitation or irresolution. Nor should you practice one koan today and another one tomorrow. You should not entertain any doubts about attaining enlightenment, nor about the koan being too deep or mysterious, and so on. All such thoughts are hindrances. I point them out to you now so that you will notice them later when they come up. Well, when he says you should not entertain any doubts about attaining enlightenment, he would also say, do not entertain any thoughts about attaining enlightenment. Doubts are thoughts. So you should not entertain any doubts or any other thoughts about attaining enlightenment. Nor about the koan being too deep or mysterious, and so on. Has anyone ever worked on a koan who didn't at times think, this is more than I can do, this is beyond me? Okay, those thoughts come up, but we don't need to indulge in them. All such thoughts are hindrances. When your work is being done well, things in the outer world will not bother you very much. But the trouble is that mental disturbances will arise feverishly in your mind without any obvious reason. Sometimes desires and lust well up, sometimes an indescribable restlessness bursts forth. Numerous other hindrances will also appear. He mentions two of what are called the five hindrances. This is a Buddhist concept. The five hindrances are desire and aversion. That's two of them. Restlessness and torpor. That's four. And doubt. So sometimes desires and lust well up. Sometimes an indescribable restlessness bursts forth. Numerous other hindrances will also appear. All these difficulties will tire you mentally and physically so that you will not know what to do. You must then realize that all these harassing experiences are produced by your meditation effort, which has stimulated into activity the seeds of habit deeply hidden in your store consciousness from the very no beginning time. This is why Sesshin is so challenging, because we are stirring up stuff that has been kind of sealed over in our mind, our body-mind. And as we make a strong effort, these things find their way to the surface and can be hindrances. They don't have to be if we recognize them. Oh, that's what he says here. At this crucial stage, you must recognize them thoroughly and break through them. Never take them as real. Never subject yourself to their control and deceptions. What you should do is to refresh your mind, alert yourself, and with a high spirit, look right at the arising point of the distracting thought. Look into its very bottom. Push your mind on and on to the impenetrable state. In this manner, exert your mind to the very, very end. Wipe out all traces of thoughts, kill them, and make all the deities and ghosts cry out. If you work like this, the good news will soon come to you. So he's, again, I think, alluding to this practice of looking into the source of your thoughts. But of course, it's the same working with any of the koans anyone here is working on, or even with the breath. The key thing is to merge with the practice. If you can break one thought into pieces, all thoughts will instantaneously be stripped off. This will be like the emergence of a clear, limpid pond when the mists have vanished. After this stage, you will feel comfortable and infinitely light, filled with boundless joy. But this is just the beginning of knowing how to work. There is nothing wonderful about it. Never rejoice and wallow in this ravishing experience. If you do, the devil of joy will possess you. I could imagine that someone hearing this could think, oh, come on, give me a little joy in the midst of all this. Well, sure, take it. But if you cling to a joyful state, then you're just inviting a backlash, because until breaking through even joy, until going beyond this, then this joy is just a conditioned state. It's precarious. You're vulnerable. We don't want to try to hold on to anything that is insecure. The one thing that is secure is our practice, because it is nothing. Anything is fundamentally insecure. We will not find security with anything. But in this realm of no mind, that is our liberation. Most of us have to just find this out the hard way. We experience a little bit of joy, exhilaration, things suddenly seem to be going really well, and then we start thinking about it. And because we're thinking about it, it slips away, and then we're miserable. After a while, when this happens enough times, some people are faster learners than others, but after a while, you see it, and you know that it's a conditioned state, and you just return the mind to the practice rather than thinking about the joy or the clarity or whatever the good state is. This is a tremendous way of developing character, is to have to face these elusive states of mind, and even the ones that we want, to see them slip away if we try to grasp them, try to hold to them. And then over time, we finally get it, that there is nothing we can grasp to. those whose hindrances are too great, whose seeds of passion are too strong, and whose habitual thoughts are too inveterately rooted in their store consciousness, not knowing how to observe their minds or how to work on the koans, should practice prostrations before the Buddha, recite sutras, and repent. These persons should also invoke mantras for through the inscrutable, I'm not going to get into this, it's not really relevant. So he's just saying that for people who are unable to meditate, which would certainly be no one here, then there are these other practices, these secondary, what are called secondary practices, that can bring stability to the mind and serve as like training wheels for getting into breath practice or koan work. For every person working on a koan in the world, there are probably 100 who are doing prostrations instead, doing repentance or reciting sutras. People who haven't been to Asia may not realize how few Buddhist practitioners do what we're doing. Most of the people I encountered in my pilgrimages in China and Tibet were doing other kinds of practices, a lot of prostrating, a lot of chanting and sutra study, sutra reading. Other devotional practices. Zazen, I think it's really fair to say that Zazen is the summit of practices. Right? We could say any kind of pure meditation where you're not asking for something. This store consciousness. It's a basic part of Buddhist doctrine that all of our sense impressions, and that includes thoughts, are deposited like seeds in this storehouse of the mind. And then when the conditions fall into place, then these seeds sprout as thoughts, words, or actions. And this is what we take the lid off this store consciousness in Sesshin. We can find, as so many of you know, we can suddenly find ourselves in some state or bedeviled by a thought, a stubborn thought that gets into the mind, or a strong storm of emotion. That's what this is. We're taking the lid off, and the lid needs to be taken off. We need to shine this light of awareness, this seeing into the mind. And it's why so few people have the resources to go through this rooting around in the store consciousness. It's it also points to the value of all the structure in Sesshin, that with such a highly structured schedule and environment, we have the stability, the container in which to let some of this stuff out. Let it, it's a flushing process, this stuff that comes out up into consciousness. It's like flushing quail out of a bush. So when we are beset by these disturbances of the mind or the body, we do need to recognize as it's happening, okay, this is part of the process. This is what happens when you're really doing serious work, when you're going for broke. These things will come up. Now, some people are more subject to these disturbances than others. Not everyone. Just because you're not having all hell breaking loose in your mind and body doesn't mean there's something wrong. You may be in great shape, but it just depends on the individual. He goes on, it is important for one to know that there are two kinds of Zen practitioners. Those who attain awakening first and then practice, and those who practice first and then attain awakening. There are also two kinds of awakening. Well, the Chinese word is wu, which he's translating as satori. I just made it awakening. But the first kind, I wouldn't consider awakening. He says the understanding wu and the realization wu. The understanding wu means coming to know the mind through the teachings and words of the Buddhas and ancestors. But here most people fall into conceptualization and intellection and cannot feel free when they encounter the activities and conflicts of life. So the translator here is just really is making a mistake in calling that satori. It's maybe other kinds of insights that come from reading and so forth, but it's not awakening as we know it. Their minds and outer objects are discrete from each other, not interfused or merged. Thus, they face obstacles all the time. This is called the resembling wu, not the real wu. And then, the realization wu results from solid and steadfast work on the koan. Those who drive their minds to the very dead end will find that their thoughts suddenly stop. Instantaneously, they behold their self nature as if a vagabond son had met his own loving mother at the crossroads of the bazaar. Like one drinking water, the practitioner knows whether it is cold or warm, and there is no room for doubt, nor is he able to express this feeling to anyone else. This is the real awakening. Possessing this awakening experience, one merges his mind with all conditions of life, cleansing all the present karmas and streams of passion and desire. Well, here he's talking about deep enlightenment, maybe even full enlightenment. Even doubts and vagaries are fused into the one real mind. This realization wu, however, has different degrees of profundity. And this, the translator puts into italics, different degrees of depth. If one is able to work on the basic principle and breaks right through the nest of the eight consciousnesses, to turn over the cave of blindness and with one great leap to pass right through, then there is nothing more for him to attain. He is indeed deserving of consideration as a highly endowed person. His realization is the deepest. Many of those who practice through gradual steps gain only shallow realizations. The worst thing is to be content with a small and shallow attainment. He continues, never allow yourself to fall into the hallucinations of fantasy. Why? Because if the eight consciousnesses are not broken through, whatever wonderful things one sees or one does are merely works of the samsaric consciousness and senses. In other words, these are just, as I said, these are conditioned phenomena that are impermanent. If one treats all these phenomena as real, it is comparable to accepting a thief as one's son. And then he says, the so-called abrupt enlightenment and gradual practice refers to the person who has already attained enlightenment in a thoroughgoing manner, but who still cannot cleanse all at once the habitual thoughts within him. How many times have people heard me emphasize this, that awakening does not purge one of defilements, but it does enable one to work on them in a more effective way. Roshi Kapo said it beautifully, that Kensho does not transform our lives. It establishes the basis for transforming our lives. Once we have seen through phenomena, then phenomena cannot bedevil us in the same way again. They cannot deceive us. They still may have staying power. They may still be tenacious in the mind. But we see them as unreal as they are. Just habit energy. He used to use the example of cutting the head off a chicken, and how after you cut off the head, they say, it scampers around a little for a few seconds before dying. How does it do that? It's reflex. It's habit force, to use Buddhist phrase. Once you've seen through the ego, how is it that you can still fall into greed, hostility, and delusion? Habit energy. He says such a person should then work on identifying his awakening with all that is encountered in his daily activity, and should put his understanding into actual use by merging it with objective events. As one portion of objective manifestation is merged with the realization, one portion of the Dharmakaya will be unfolded. And as one portion of delusory thought is dissolved, one portion of Prajna wisdom will come to light. I think what he's saying here is that through awareness, through mindfulness in our daily lives, to notice when we have a choice between going with the habit energy or refraining from that, to see it as that and to choose in accordance with what we have awakened to, and not just default to this path of least resistance that we have done so many countless times in the past. So in the case of anger, someone says something to you or does something, and you notice the anger. That's the first thing, is to notice it. It's not easy. It's often not easy to have the self-awareness at that moment that, all right, I feel anger coming up here. I'm getting angry. That's more than half the battle, just to notice it. Because once we notice it, then we have some freedom of choice. We can, now that we've identified it, we've recognized it, then we have some ability to not react. And then he says, the crucial point of this practice is continuity and consistency. Continuity and consistency. And now, just to get started on another discourse, this is the discourse of Master Po Shan. This is a different master. I couldn't find any biographical material on him. So we'll just dive in the little time we have left. When working on Zen, the important thing is to generate the doubt sensation. What is this doubt sensation? Well, as an example, where did I come from before my birth, and where shall I go after my death? He says, since one does not know the answer to either question, a strong feeling of doubt arises in the mind. Now, doubt here doesn't mean skepticism. Doubt means questioning, puzzlement, or I think the best way to understand doubt is wondering. Stick this doubt mass onto your forehead and keep it there all the time until you can neither drive it away nor put it down, even if you wanted to. Then suddenly you will discover that the doubt mass has been crushed, that you have broken it into pieces. The masters of old said, the greater the doubt, the greater the awakening. The smaller the doubt, the smaller the awakening. No doubt, no awakening. So, questioning. This is what distinguishes a koan from breath practice. The element of questioning. In breath practice, there's nothing to question. In a koan, there is a contradictory element, something that is illogical, that has a bite to it, and that presents the opportunity to harness this questioning mind that is a uniquely human endowment. Who am I? What am I? What is this? What is the meaning of my life? Where did I come from? Where will I go? What is death? What is life? What is this? Or as Garrison Keillor would say with Guy Noir, one man still seeks the answer to life's persistent questions. Now, some people working on koans, a lot of people actually, report that the questioning just isn't there. They don't feel the questioning. Or when they try to drum up some questioning, it just feels contrived, artificial. If this is the case, then my advice is that you don't try to do what feels contrived. That you, instead of questioning, you just try to merge with the koan. Become one with it. And then when you reach a certain greater degree of unity with the koan, let's say mu, when you become more intimate with mu, then it will become puzzling. Questioning will arise on its own. You can try to sort of turn the soil if you don't have much questioning. You can just from time to time, even though it feels a little bit from the outside, you can say, you know, what is this mu? This mu, of course, is just a word for our true nature, ultimate reality. So what is mu? Just turn it around some, and then if it doesn't seem to be anything is germinating from that, then just the pure absorption in the word mu. But remember, people who are working on, for example, mu, have an assignment. The assignment is to find out what mu is and demonstrate it. What is it? There's the question. What is it? Poshan continues, when working on Zen, the worst thing is to become attached to quietness, because this will unknowingly cause you to be engrossed in dead stillness. Then you will develop an inordinate fondness for quietness and at the same time an aversion for activity of any kind. Once those who have lived amidst the noise and restlessness of worldly affairs experience the joy of quietness, they become captivated by its honey-sweet taste, craving it like an exhausted traveler who seeks a peaceful den in which to slumber. How can people with such an attitude retain their awareness? It's interesting that this paragraph follows his what he says about doubt sensation and questioning, because without questioning, one is at greater peril of slipping into this dead quietness. The koan can become misused as a kind of a tranquilizer. So, but even without questioning, it doesn't have to be a tranquilizer. You can, with rapt attention, keen absorption in the practice. It can be lively, it can be vibrant, but there must be that kind of intense concentration. Otherwise, one does risk just having a wonderful sleep, wonderful soothing sesshin, but without doing what one can do, is to break through this discriminating consciousness through the koan. Well, we'll continue with this tomorrow. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.